You're listening to the Writer's Digest podcast with Gabriella Pereira, the show to help ignite your creative vision so you can write better and get published. Welcome, welcome, writers. From fiction to nonfiction, whatever your genre persuasion, whether you love reading and writing humor, or you only enjoy literature that is extraordinarily, deeply serious. I'm so thrilled that you're here. You see, today we are going to be talking all about humor writing. This is the fourth episode of the Writer's Digest podcast, and we're going to be breaking apart humor and what exactly makes something funny. But first things first, this podcast is produced by Writer's Digest, the largest online writing community and educational website in the world. I'm Gabriella Pereira, founder of DIYMFA.com and your host for this show. Before we get started, I'd like to remind you that the show notes for this episode are at writersdigest.com/ep4, or EP4, because it's our fourth episode. Also, this episode of the Writer's Digest podcast is brought to you by the Writer's Digest Annual Conference. I love this conference. This event offers everything you need to advance your career both creatively and professionally. Writers of all backgrounds and experience levels, including me, will gather in August in New York City to sharpen their skills, pitch their work to literary agents, and find inspiration in the words of experienced mentors. Also, don't miss out on the all-new screenwriting programming. This is so awesome, and it was created to celebrate the upcoming merger of Script Mag and WD. Now, I don't know about you, but I always learn so much more and stretch my writing skills when I try something that's a little bit outside my writing comfort zone. So you can bet that I'm going to be checking out those screenwriting sessions in August as well. You can join me and a gazillion other awesome people at the Writer's Digest Conference and take $25 off your registration just by using the code WDPOD18. At writersdigestconference.com. Again, that code is WDPOD18. Now, today I have the pleasure of interviewing Lori Kilmartin. Comedian and Emmy-nominated Conan staff writer, Lori gained significant attention in 2014 for live-tweeting the death of her father. In 2016, her hour-long stand-up special titled 45 Jokes About My Dead Dad was named one of the best comedy specials of the year by Vulture, Paste, and Decider. And it was featured in the New York Times year-end piece, A Year When Death Loomed in the Laughter. You also have to check out Lori's new book titled Dead People Suck. And it's also about the death of her father. And it's just such a warm and moving book that will both have you laughing and crying all at the same time. Now sit back, relax, and listen in while Lori and I talk about how to use humor to tackle some of life's more difficult topics. Welcome, Lori. It is so great to have you on the show. So humor is one of those areas of writing that you know a lot about, and I'm so excited to have you here.
I'm excited too. Thank you so much.
And you know, it's funny about humor. It's one of those things that I think a lot of people dismiss in favor of, say, like more serious literature. But for me, it's something that I love. I love humor. I love watching comedies. And I find that as humans, we tend to use humor a lot in order to tackle really difficult subjects.
Yeah, I agree, especially your first statement of, like, if you just look at Oscars, they always go to a serious movie.
I know, right?
They never go to a comedy, and I'm telling you, comedy is so much harder. If you've seen any comedy, you'll be like, oh, I love the first half, but the second half, it fell flat. It's so hard to get right. It has to be so precise that, yeah, I think people underestimate how difficult it is to really get it right.
I completely agree. So let's unpack that a little bit. Since you dug into that right in the beginning, I really wanted to talk to you about like how humor works, because I feel like people don't realize that humor has certain rules to it. Like the same way that like writing a thriller or writing a romance has rules, like there are rules to writing humor well. So can you dig into like how that works. Like, what makes something funny? How does humor work? I know, the big question, right out of the gate.
I've been doing stand-up for over 30 years, and I'm still trying to figure it out. I mean, it's so strange. Like, you never know if you have it right until you tell a joke to somebody else. And then if they laugh, you're like, oh, it's a good one. And all your years of preparation can't actually, they can't tell you till you get it out in front of a crowd or you get it in front of somebody else who reads it and it makes them laugh. I guess the rule is that the audience has to be surprised by the punchline. That's the only thing that makes you have that involuntary reaction of a laugh. And so that's the hard rule. And how you get there is like everyone's personal hell. How you get to that punchline. It's, you know, basically it's at that point, it's just like any other writing where you're trying to pick the exact right words, where you want to mislead somebody a little bit, but not so much that the punchline doesn't make sense. And at that point, you're just, you know, you're just picking words.
You know, it's interesting also, like what you said about the punchline being surprising, because I find that the funniest jokes are the ones where it's both surprising and yet the punchline was staring you in the face from the very beginning. Like it was right there, right in front of you. And yet as the listener to the joke, we didn't see it. And then suddenly the person who's telling the joke or writing the joke manages to like come back around and like flag the thing we've been staring at from the very beginning.
Yes. Basically, we're trying to stay 10 seconds ahead of the audience all the time. Because if they had just a little bit more time or the reader to figure it out, they would figure it out before we tell them. So we're just trying to stay a little bit ahead of you. And it's kind of like, you know, just if you're in an escape room, you're like, I can't get out of this place. And then you find all the clues and it's like, oh, yeah, of course, that was pretty easy now that I look back on it. And so that's what a good joke is. The reader or the listener doesn't know where we're going. We know we're going somewhere. And then when you get there, you're like, oh, duh, of course. All those clues were laid out in the setup.
I think another piece, too, is that feeling of like relatability, that like as listeners, we see ourselves reflected in the story that the joke is telling, whatever that story may be. And it's at the same time, the story is always very specific to the one telling the joke. Like I think of, you know, anyone who's done stand up, like usually it's pulling from their own life experience. And yet me being from, say, a very different life experience than, you know, say, a male comedian can still relate to some of the stuff they're talking about because it's stuff that has that sort of universality.
Yeah. I mean, you are also, depending on the audience, having some empathy.
Exactly.
So, you know, the audience or the reader has to be able to suspend, you know, their own life and go, I'm willing to go on you on this journey. I'm going to pretend I'm going to be a black male, or I'm going to pretend I'm going to be a white woman, or whatever. However, you are different from the joke teller. You have to be willing to jump into their shoes a little bit. But, you know, it's a two-way street, but a good comedian or a good comedy writer will lay it all out for you. So it's not a big leap. Like you can easily walk in their shoes.
Exactly. And you mentioned also the setup of like setting up the joke. So when you're thinking about like you're testing out material for a joke or for a routine, like how do you put together that setup for your punchline?
You know, this is I can tell you a joke that I was working on for a long time that was hit or miss. And then I added a little bit to the setup and then it was like hit almost all the time. Would you like that?
Yeah, that's amazing. That would be fantastic. Okay. Yes, break it down for us.
So this is I'll just do the whole joke and then I'll tell you how it got the way it was. So I just say, this is like an early joke in my act, so no one really knows anything about me. I'm a single mother and I just tried mushrooms for the first time. Not because I wanted to get high. I'm hoping to lose custody of my son. So that's the joke.
Okay.
And I used to start it by saying, I just tried mushrooms for the first time. Not because I wanted to get high. I'm hoping to lose custody of my son. And I think because I thought, oh, this is where they'll find out I'm a mother. And it's almost like they had to find out too much in the punchline. So it didn't always work because people had to go, oh, she has a kid. And so when I changed it, when I added that information in the setup and I try to make it, and I tell it like, I'm like, hey, I just tried something crazy and I'm not supposed to because I'm a single mother. And I sort of set it up like, like, hey, I'm being wild for a second, then the punchline of I'm trying to get the police to take my son hits harder because people aren't expecting it. I was sort of leading it in this other direction of, you know, I was crazy for one day and people are sort of happy for me. Like usually they go, woo, or something like, wow, she's crazy. You know how you would be for someone who did something out of character. And so that's a misdirect that, and by the way, breaking down a joke makes it feel really unfunny. It's horrible to do, but it just explain it.
But I think it's so useful because it's like in breaking down the mechanics, it's kind of like taking apart a car. Not that I know anything about cars, but like taking apart a car, you put it back together again. I mean, if I put it back together, it would be a hot mess. You wouldn't be able to drive it, but at least like I'd see how it works. So I love
this. Yes. And so the punchline is actually much more sinister. And then, and in the setup, you think I'm just sort of an innocent person who wanted to have fun once. And then in the punchline, it's like, oh, she's really a horrible mother and a bad person. So it's a pretty effective, when I say effective, it gets a pretty good laugh in a nightclub. It's a pretty effective joke. And it also, it kind of tells people very early on a lot about me and my joke style, so they can get used to to who I am pretty quickly.
I think that's really important too, because like one of the things, so I was watching, as I was prepping for this interview, I watched a whole bunch of different clips of you doing your stand-up, and there's definitely a common thread, the sort of, you know, funny, but also dark. And I think that's true for a lot of comedians. Like there's a lot of darkness in comedy. I think a lot of people, myself included, by the way, I have a lot of darkness in my own world, and yet I use humor a lot to deflect it because that's my coping mechanism. And I think that's the case for a lot of people who lean on humor as like their primary avenue. And so I think setting up that ground rule for your audience is super important. It's like when we write a book, we're kind of laying, like in the first chapter of a book in a novel, say, we're kind of setting the rules up. Like these are the main characters, here are the people you should care about, et cetera, et cetera. I think it's the same thing when you're telling jokes. Like you have to tell the audience kind of what the rules are, or else you're going to have people walking out halfway through if suddenly you throw them a curveball.
Right. I mean, it's not different from any other writing.
Exactly.
You need to let them know what's coming, but do it in a way where they can't figure it out before you get to what's coming. So yeah, I agree.
So usually I start interviews, but we got like into the sort of nuts and bolts so quickly, which I thought was amazing. But I love to start interviews by going down memory lane a little bit and talking about sort of how you got started as a writer. So can you tell us a little bit about sort of your superhero origin story, as it were? How did you get started? Where did your superpowers come from? And why did you choose to write comedy?
I got started as a stand-up. And so that's a very specific kind of writing, because you're writing stuff that needs to be performed by yourself. So it's a very specific style. And a lot of jokes that work on stage won't work on paper and vice versa. And then I started writing, I guess, prose in the late 90s, like 98, 99, or 97. I had a website pretty early on, and I used to write a weekly update that I would call This Week's Hoax, because I didn't want to be held accountable in case I got things wrong. But I basically wanted to detail what my life on the road was like that previous week. And mostly because I thought I would forget, but also I just in case anyone cared what it was like to be a road comic. And there weren't that many comics with websites, and then there was hardly anybody writing about what it was like to be a comic. So I would put one out every Tuesday, and that's how I got kind of, I guess, good at writing my own voice on paper, or not paper, on, you know, on Word or a text editor, whatever it was at the time, but to be read as opposed to be listened to. And I kept that up every week till about 2004. And then I got a writing job on this show on Comedy Central called Tough Crowd with Colin Quinn. And at that point, I didn't have as much time to really spend a couple hours a week, you know, working on a hoax, which is what I called them. And the other is that all of a sudden I was doing a lot of stuff I couldn't really write about, or I didn't know if I could write about, because now I'm dealing with, you know, kind of celebrities or celebrity comedians. And I'm like, am I even allowed to tell people I do this? I wasn't really sure what the rules are. So I just sort of shut it down. I stopped doing it. But that's sort of how I developed a voice like that. And, you know, I started writing for television a lot. So that took up a lot of my time. And then the first book I wrote, oddly enough, is I ghost wrote Sherry Shepherd's memoir. She used to be on The View, and she's a comedian, and it's called Permission Slips. And from what I understand, the first ghostwriter kind of quit, and they had a really hard deadline. And a friend led me to my then agent, who said, you know, can you do this in like 3 months? And I had no idea how to do it. So I said, yes. I was like, how hard could it be? And so of course I barely, you know, I did it, barely did it, and had carpal tunnel by the end, because I was writing around a writing job. So it was like early mornings, late nights, and all that kind of stuff, weekends, all that. And that ended up how I wrote Shitty Mom. And that's how I wrote this book too, is I wrote around a writing job and stand up and a kid and stuff. It's a lot of writing a book really ruins your life for the amount of time you're doing it, because you can't, there's no amount of free time. Every time you have a free moment or a free night, you're like, I should be working on that thing. And so you can't even enjoy watching television, because you're like, I shouldn't be doing this. This thing is due in 3 months and it sucks and I should be working on it. It really destroys the amount of time that you have to write it, by the way.
I wholeheartedly agree. I had a similar experience when I was writing the DIY MFA book. So it's a long slog. There's so much in there that we need to unpack. So we're going to unpack it slowly. One of them was this idea of the performative aspect of comedy versus writing for a show. Can you talk a little bit more about that? Like, I'm curious about, for instance, when you're writing something that you're going to be performed, what does that writing process look like? Do you write it like walking around? Like, I know, for instance, I do a lot of speaking. I did a TEDx last year. When I'm writing to speak, I tend to actually speak it first. And then I sit down and I write down and I'm like, okay, wait, what did I just say? And I sit down at my computer and write it. And then I'm walking around my office and then I'm talking and then I sit down and write it. That's what my process looks like. So I'm curious, what does your process of getting those words and capturing them when the end result is something that you get up on stage to perform?
Oh, okay. I have two answers for this. One of them, because I write for Conan O'Brien on the Conan show. And so how I write for myself is very much like in the shower, as something occurs to me when I'm walking around. Jokes always sneak up on me for my own self. They sneak up on me when I'm doing something else. And then usually when I actually sit down and write for my own self, my own performing self, it's when I'm at a comedy club and I'm going up pretty soon. Then all of a sudden there's that pressure of, I want to figure this joke out before I get up on stage and try it. And in those like 10 or 15 minutes where I have to myself, but I know that I'm going up next or next, that's when I do a lot of tweaking and fine tuning of things. How I write for Conan is that's just sitting down at a desk and writing a bunch of setups, which is like, you know, are like news stories. You just, you know, there's three of us monologue writers, and we each write out a bunch of news setups, and then we kind of pool them together, and then we take all of our setups and just write jokes off the ones that pop the most for us. And that's very much opening up a Word doc and just churning them out. And it's a little different because, I mean, when you're writing those kind of jokes for somebody else, you have to have their voice in your head, and you kind of have to know their rules. Like, what words he'll say, you know, if your person isn't comfortable with swearing, or if they are, or, you know, how much in the weeds can you go in politics? You know, that's kind of knowing who your audience is. You know, if you're writing for John Oliver or Trevor Noah, that audience is, they know a lot about politics, so you can really get really specific. And our audience isn't super political, so we don't get too deep into political news. So it's sort of like knowing your audience and knowing your host. And once you have those sort of rules in your head, you can sort of churn those jokes out pretty quickly, surprisingly quickly. When I first started, I was like, how am I going to write like 40 jokes a day? Oh my God. Cause I only write for myself when I'm in the shower, you know, and that's like maybe one joke a day, you know, and it does become pretty easy once you figure out it's a different kind of writing, but once you figure that out. So that's how I, for me, that's how I write for performing. One is for a different performer and for myself.
You know, it's interesting also, because as you were talking about writing for a show like Conan, where, you know, you have to understand the host's voice, and then you have to understand sort of the rules of what the audience is expecting and what they're looking for. I'm sort of translating in my own mind, like, okay, what would that look like, say, for a novelist or for a nonfiction writer? Obviously, for writers of nonfiction, knowing who your audience is and who your prescriptive nonfiction, particularly, like, that's really important. Like, that's something that naturally nonfiction writers are leaning on all the time. But even for writers of fiction, like if you're writing romance, you kind of know what romance readers are expecting. And then when you were talking about sort of the voice of the host, like I'm almost thinking like, well, that's the same as getting inside a character's head. Like if I'm getting into the character, you know, Mary Sue, whoever, who I'm writing, like suddenly like that character becomes crystal clear in my mind. The minute you think about like that, like, it's just the same thing, but extending it to like a live person. Kind of awesome, actually, that you get to put words in a live human being's mouth, which I think is kind of fun.
Yeah, it's cool. I mean, I remember, of course, I remember the first time he did one of my jokes after I got hired. I got hired and I had that, oh, I'm a fraud. I had all the, you know, the imposter syndrome trauma that everyone has. And then when he started telling jokes that I wrote, I was like, oh my God. You know, maybe I'm not a fraud. Now it took a couple of years, but now I'm like, oh, you know, I'm a decent joke writer. So I don't, you know, that's the highest compliment I'll give myself, because it changes every day. Some days I'm really good, and some days I suck. You know, I mean, that's why a comedy show has so many writers, because you have to, you know, someone's gonna suck every day, and you just hope everyone doesn't suck on the same day. And usually, you know, you have somebody that's on fire one day, and you know, that can offset. And another day you'll be the one that's offsetting somebody else's bad day. You know, people have personal lives, and things bleed over into your work day. And so that's why you have a bunch of writers that can, hopefully everyone's, you know, not awful on the same day.
I love that idea of the teamwork element. And also when you were talking about, like, you know, the oh my gosh moment of like, oh my gosh, you read my joke. So I in a past life, I used to design toys, and I worked for this small toy company. And I swear, I still walk into toy stores and go, I made that. Like, did you ever have that moment where like you like recorded a thing and you're like, that's my joke. That's me. Hey mom, look, that's me.
Oh, neat. Yes, definitely. Yeah, for sure. Oh, that's really cool.
But yeah, like there's got to be that moment of like, oh my God, that's my thing that I created, that it's like on the TV. And like, I don't know, that's pretty awesome.
Yeah, it's that. And then also some of our, like our, I don't know if we print all or we make little meme cards for our monologue jokes. Maybe not all of them, but the ones that do really well, I think go on a, you know, a little JPEG of Conan and get pushed on Facebook and stuff. And sometimes when yours gets really passed around and there's like a billion comments on it, you're like, that was me.
Yay. That's awesome. So the other thing that I thought was really interesting that you brought up was that tug of war between writing as your job and then also writing sort of on the side for your own personal projects. And I think that's something that I think for a lot of listeners, that might not be the case. Like they probably have day jobs, but they're probably not writing day jobs. But there's a particular kind of tension, I think, that arises. And I know I feel that all the time with DIY MFA and the work that I do, that like there's that tug of war between like my writing job and then the writing I want to do for me. And so how do you navigate that? You talked about like, you know, early morning, late nights, but how do you do that around having a kid and a job and all the other stuff that happens in life?
I learned that even little pieces of time are valuable. You know, it's part of me is like, oh, you know, I have to set aside a whole day on Saturday. And then, you know, leading up to, you know, if I think that on Monday morning and I'm grim the whole week leading up to Saturday, because I know it's going to be awful and something's going to interrupt, you know, my writing day. So to me, a really important thing was I would tell myself even 15 minutes is good. Like I can come up with something good in 15 minutes. And so I would just try to sneak little patches of time and keep, you know, like write notes on what I needed to work on and what I needed to look at again and what I needed to reread and tweak because it didn't feel good or doesn't feel finished. And I got so much done in little 15-minute chunks or little half hour chunks in the morning before my son would wake up. And it doesn't seem like a lot. It seems like you need to be 8 hours a day on your laptop working. And I found that, I couldn't do that. And even when I had a whole day like that, who can sit that long? You go mad, you know? So I really wrote like Dead People Suck. I wrote it in, increments of 15 to an hour, probably, for the most part. Every once in a while, I'd get on a plane that didn't have Wi-Fi. And I was like, oh, all right, I get it. I'll work on this thing. But yeah, it was just little patches of time.
Yeah, I totally hear you. I actually edited and proofread The Galley for my book only on plane trips. Like, it was kind of insane, but it happened that I had all these speaking gigs right when revisions and galleys, proofs were due. And so like, it was all, I'd get on the plane, I'd be like, hallelujah, there's no Wi-Fi, no temptation. All right, we're sitting down.
I know. And the other thing, I would be like, oh, I'm in the middle seat, people can read it, I'm not going to work on it. Like, I had to have a window seat so I could angle the computer away.
Exactly.
I had to have bought extra room. So that's an extra $99 so that there was room for the laptop. Cause it's, the seating is so crunched in economy now, you almost can't even angle your laptop a certain way. So there are all these little conditions that I had to meet before I would really be able to lose myself writing on a plane. But yeah, I mean, that's a great place to write. It's a very expensive way to write, is a cross-country trip, but it you really, can force yourself to not be able to do anything else, which is good.
Exactly. The window seat is key, because then you don't have people like trying to jump over you every 10 minutes or whatever, or moving a little cart down the aisle and like jabbing you in the elbow.
Yes. And you can just gaze out the window too. You need to do that too.
I know. Like, where does inspiration come from?
Exactly. It comes when you're flying over Kansas.
Exactly. It's like the little patches on the ground start to like create a pattern. And before you know it, you're like, Eureka! And then you write your chapter.
Exactly.
So you mentioned Dead People Suck, your most recent book, and I've been reading it, and it's both hilarious and heart-wrenching, which I think is true for a lot of comedy. What drew you to write this book and to angle it in this way? Like, there's a lot of funny mixed in with the death. Like, what drew you to have that approach in this story?
Yeah, it's about my dad's hospice and his eventual death and the funeral and all that kind of stuff that comes after. My dad had lung cancer and he died in 2014. And I guess what really compelled me was I was surprised at how difficult it was and how shocking it was. And my dad died, he was 83, so it wasn't tragic. He was totally in that death range where you shouldn't be surprised that the person dies. And yet I was totally devastated. And I was like, no, months afterwards, I'm like, not my dad. Like, I get that everyone else's dad was going to die, but not mine. This is ridiculous. And I couldn't believe how unprepared I was and how depressed I was. And that was sort of funny to me, that reaction. And then when my dad was in hospice, it's so surreal. And, it's because I'm a joke writer. That was my first reaction. It was just to write a bunch of jokes about it and just to sort of kind of try to position it. And that's sort of how I deal with all emotions and, any parenting emotion, any dating emotion or situation, is I try to, that's to me making the best of a situation is trying to come up with a joke about it. So that's just how I acted then too. So I had a bunch of jokes. I had a bunch of things that were funny. And they didn't all work in a nightclub setting. Like I immediately tried to do all of them in my act. And as you can imagine, people coming out to a comedy club, they kind of want to hear dick jokes, basically. And so when you start going, and then my dad died, you're going to lose a significant portion of the audience. So I tell a few jokes now, but I had a whole bunch of extra material that maybe didn't work on stage. And it also, because I needed to really explain a lot of stuff that was real, it's not a comedy club setting, and it worked better in this book because I could sort of go back and forth between, real painful stuff which is sort of your setup, and then your jokes, which, you know, come afterwards. And this is a better place to go in that direction, where you had to sort of tell a truth about a person who's dying, and that's always a little painful, and then get to the jokes.
You know, what's interesting also is that there's a lot of, like, a lot of the setup being so dark, in a way, having that humorous release is in some ways even more releasing for the audience, I think. Like, when something's funny from the get-go, then it's sort of like making it, like, the punchline doesn't add that extra layer of, like, elevation to the content, you know what I mean? But when you're starting with something that's more harrowing, that it's like you're building up even more tension into the joke, so that then when you have that punchline release, it's like, it almost like it allows the reader to breathe more, because suddenly there's some piece of their own tension is lifted from having read that piece or that joke or experienced that.
Definitely. I mean, you know, for me, I mean, I had to set up, like, I loved my dad and him dying was awful. And so you need to know that so that when I start making a million jokes about it, you don't think I'm just this monster who was a psychopath born without feeling. It's like, no, I was devastated. And yet this is the direction I took as I went down comedy lane. I did want to set up that, just so everyone's on board, I would happily unwrite this book if I could, you know, have my dad for one more week, you know. But oh well, here we are. Can't do that.
So when you were, and there was also like the whole Twitter thing around, like, that preceded this book, like when you were going through that experience, can you talk a little bit about what that was and like why you did that?
I was just tweeting jokes that, because I normally, my dad came home to die. He had home hospice. And so my sister and I, you know, we got the news. We were all sort of summoned back to my parents' house, to our family home, and to be with our dad. And, you know, you kind of don't want to leave the house when someone's dying there, because you don't know, you don't want to be gone when they die. And so sort of trapped. And hospice is actually a million things. And one of them is boring. You know, you're just sitting around, and sometimes the person that's dying falls asleep, and, you know, you and your other family members are just trapped in this house, and you're waiting for something awful to happen that you don't want to happen. And so that creates quite a bit of tension. And for me, you know, for me, that's the way I release it, as jokes. And so I just kept tweeting about them, because that was the only way I could kind of get a laugh, was to get a response on Twitter. And I sort of need that after I started comedy in 1987. So I am in the habit of getting some sort of, I need some kind of approval every single day. And so that's sort of how I ended up doing that. I wasn't consciously thinking, oh, I'm going to like tweet my dad's death, but I was tweeting a situation I was in. And had I been, you know, stuck in traffic or something, or whatever, if had I been in any other situation, I probably would have tweeted about it as well, you know, as long as it was safe. But this was a very, you know, particular situation that I think was maybe a little surprising to people at the time. But, you know, for me, it was sort of natural. It was a natural response to a very shocking event.
In some ways, too, I mean, you touched on this, but like, there's a sort of performative aspect of social media as well, right? And so you touched on this when you said, like, you know, having been in comedy and sort of like that performing and sort of the sharing of the jokes, in some ways it was almost like sharing of this experience as well on social media. It seems it makes sense to me why, like, to go that way. And then did those jokes eventually kind of help you shape the book, or was that something that you just kind of did in the moment and it happened there, and then you just sort of decided later, like, okay, I'm going to write this book? Because the book is very different. It's not just jokes about the experience. It's got more of a how-to-esque feeling to it. So I'm interested in sort of the connection of the process of getting to writing the book in this way.
I had made a lot of notes when my dad was dying. I wasn't thinking I was going to write a book, but I just wanted to remember it, because you know, I guess I know enough to know that every time you think, oh, I'll remember this, you forget it. So And I just wanted to be able to remember it correctly. I wasn't thinking beyond that. It also was so strange. I just had to keep making notes, you know, about it. And then when I went back to write a book, there was a lot of stuff I'd forgotten. And I was so grateful I'd written some notes. I was like, oh, yeah, that. The jokes also helped me remember. Like, I went back to read my tweets when I was writing the book. And some of the jokes worked in the book, and some of them reminded me of a situation that I needed to write about, you know, reminded me of, like, there's a chapter about how dying people get very obsessed with weird things that you had no idea were on their mind. And I guess I had forgotten about that, but my dad all of a sudden had this very strange obsession with a wagon wheel chandelier that he insisted was in the attic of the house. And he always wished he had drug it down and hung it. And we were like, what? And we couldn't find it. But he brought it up many times in the last days of his life, and he had never mentioned it before. And it was so odd that that was on his mind. You know, it was really interesting, and I still wish we had found it. But part of me is like, well, good, maybe we didn't, and it's just going to be stuck in the house, you know, for the next dying person to obsess about. But those notes really helped me. But at the time, I wasn't thinking I was going to write a book or anything.
So now that you've written the book, have things shifted? Like, has your perspective on the experience shifted, changed? Where, you know, like, I feel like writing a book is sort of, not to equate it with childbirth, but it is, like, in some ways, like, as a mom, like, there is a sort of before and after feeling that I had when I had my children and I had when I wrote my book. So how did, like, where you are now, how does that relate to where you were before you wrote this book and the experience of writing it?
Well, I agree about the childbirth, especially when the thing about childbirth and writing a book is you forget how hard it is once you finish it.
Uh-huh.
You're like, oh yeah, I did that. But, you know, then once you start the next one, you get pregnant again. Not that I've been pregnant many times, but it's like, oh my God, no. And you know what's coming and you're like, oh, what was I thinking?
And there's also that feeling of like, oh, wait, you birthed this book, but now there's maintenance attached to it, kind of like with kids, right? Like, you know, while in my mind, I had that feeling of like, okay, like I'm clearly my children will be here once they are born, but it wasn't quite crystal clear for me until they were physically present in my arms. Like, oh, shoot, I need to take care of this thing now. Like, there's that like moment of like, holy cow, how am I going to do this? And, you know, it's kind of the same thing with a book. You know, you're kind of like, oh, now I need to promote it. Oh, now I need to take care of this thing.
Yeah. It's ongoing. But I hopefully this won't last as long as raising a child. I don't want to be promoting this for 18 years. But but I forgot. What was your question after
so
that?
So the before and after, like now that you've written it and now that you're sort of past that hurdle of producing this book and putting it out into the world, sort of has your perspective on the experience that you describe in the book, has that shifted at all?
Yeah, I guess now it feels more like mine again, because before I spent a great deal of time parsing through every experience and every memory and seeing how I could turn it into something else, like a chapter in my book. And now that I'm done with that, I feel like my memories of my dad are mine and not something I have to like take apart and try to make funny, which is nice. Like I was just coming home from a gig, a stand-up gig in the Bay Area, and I was driving a certain way that I used to drive to go to my parents' house when I would finish a show, you know, in the 90s. And I was a little sad because I was driving down the 5, Interstate 5 in California, and I just wanted to keep driving right into 1994 and go home and have my dad be there with a box of wine and ask me how the show was and stuff. And it was nice to just have that memory and not go, oh, that's something I could write down. All right, you know, let me make a few notes and turn that into something. So now I can just have memories of my dad without feeling like this is, you know, potential material. And that's nice.
Yeah. Do you ever have like humor exhaustion? Like, do you ever feel like at some point you just want to stop, like what you just described about the experience with your dad, but like with everything, where you just kind of want to not have to be looking at the world and be funny about it.
It's not a humor exhaustion. It's more, I don't want to analyze. It's more analysis exhaustion. It's more the work of trying to find something, unless it just comes to you in a funny way. The work of trying to find comedy in something is, you know, you just have to dive deep into analysis. The comedy part kind of comes easy once you start going, this is absurd and that's absurd. But it's more that, all right, I get more of that with Trump as opposed to anything in my life where I'm just like tired of the topics. That's more of the news cycle.
So you touched on analysis, and it's interesting because this kind of brings us full circle to where we were at the beginning and sort of breaking apart what makes something funny and what humor is about. So when you do that analysis, what kind of stuff are you looking for?
Anything that feels off, that's about it. It's got to kind of go, you just look for it. It feels like a physical opening in between the words that is a place you could jump in and try to make a joke, if that makes sense.
That makes total sense. So as we wrap up, if you could give writers one piece of advice, one thing that can help them get published, what would that advice be?
Well, you know, from my point of view is kind of like as a stand-up. And so what I tell people that want to get good at joke writing is to write, to tweet. Because, it used to be 140 characters, which was so good because it really forced you to really edit. And every word is so important in a tweet if you're trying to make a joke. You know, 280 is, you can get a little rambly. I mean, in terms of getting your name out there, if you're writing good, consistent jokes, people will start to notice. I mean, it's crowded now. I mean, obviously, as with any kind of thing like that, it was great to get in early. But I do think if you're writing comedy and you're trying to get some attention, people will go to a Twitter feed to see what you do. And your name's attached to it. It's something. It's like little audition pieces all the time. And I think that helps.
I love it. Well, it's been such a blast having you on the show today, Lori. It's been just really eye-opening.
Oh, cool. Yeah, this is a fun interview. Thank you so much.
All right, everyone. That wraps it up for today. Okay, writers, stop listening and start writing. Thank you for listening to the Writer's Digest podcast with Gabriella Pereira, founder of DIYMFA.com. This podcast was edited by Marielle Orff, and special thanks goes out to Samantha Sanders, Tyler Moss, and Jess Zafaris.